The Oracle Network.
Welcome back to part two of my conversation with Charlie from Crime Lines. In this episode, we delve pretty deeply into mental health with regards to victimology, but we also talk about our own issues with mental health and mental health on a broader scale.
So how long have you been doing your YouTube channel for now?
So I started in February. So it's I have a few videos that are older than that because I started at one point posting my podcast episodes to my YouTube, and then I stopped, and then but I started in February posting in earnest, but I've found this summer was so hard to get anything done more than the podcast. Between traveling and kids being home and needing rides and appointments and stuff, I couldn't really keep up with it. So I only have a few videos in the last couple months, but I need to get back to it. I have one video that was pretty much almost ready to go, and then I got to the end and the audio crapped out, so I need to re-record, and that was annoying. So I need to do that. But yeah, I've had it for a few months. I think I have like 4,000 subscribers, so that was pretty exciting to get to like the 1,000 subscriber benchmark. That's when you can put ads on it, and I was like, oh, I'm monetized, that's so great. And then they pay they pay so poorly. They pay lower. Their CPM is lower than podcast CPMs for those pre-recorded ads. I would make more money if I just recorded all my YouTube videos audio and put it on my podcast feed. I'd make more money that way. But, you know, I'm trying to diversify.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. It's a big learning curve, right? Learning how to edit video and put everything together.
Yes.
Because your videos are really good.
Yeah, thank you. I'm trying to make them interesting to look at. So it's not just me talking, but it's not just a static screen, but also not just a voiceover. I'm trying to use everything, but it's been difficult to just try to get all the slides together. It's a lot of work. And it's sometimes I'm like, why am I doing this? But I think once I kind of hit the point where it was like fun, and then I got to the point where it was like work, and now I need to just push through till it's easier, and then I'll be fine. Same with podcasting.
How do you juggle all this? Like, you have Crime Lines, which you do a great amount of research on, you know, writing, recording, and then your channel, plus being a mom and a wife, and then you write Rusty Hinges.
Yeah, well, writing Rusty Hinges is like once every 3 months ordeal. But no, for the most part, I mean, podcasting is my full-time job. So, you know, I'm not juggling another job. It's always when people also work that I'm like, why, how, I don't know. So my kids are gone. I mean, they go to school or daycare from, you know, I drop the last one off at 9, and then I have till about 3:30 until I pick people up. So I just work on the podcast during that. And I've been doing it for so long that it's pretty quick. Then, you know, I spend a lot of time on the research. The writing, though, is very fast for me when I'm writing Crime Lines, because I'm writing in my voice. I'm not writing like Rusty Hinges is more difficult because I'm writing a script for someone else to perform, and I've got to get jokes in there and everything's got to sound right. Crime Lines is just written the way I talk. So I just kind of write what I would say to explain things. I have to write it out or I'll forget everything. So it is all scripted, but the writing's pretty easy. And then, you know, it kind of balances out. For every episode I do where the research is just like so much work, there are other times where I find an appellate document that literally gives me all the information and I only have a few gaps to fill in. You know, then that kind of makes up for the things where I have to go day by day through the newspaper archives to get enough. So sometimes, even though my missing and murdered Indigenous women cases are sometimes my shortest, they're short, but sometimes they take me more time because I have to go through the newspaper. There's no definitive source for this, so I have to go through the newspaper archives. I did a Canadian case of a First Nations woman who went missing. Well, she went missing. She was murdered. And there was a trial and everything. And I could find pretty much nothing online about it. Like, there was next to nothing online. And so what I had to do is go into the newspaper archives. And there was tons in there. Like, it just, whatever happened just never got digitized, right? And so I went in the newspaper archives and I had to go through them literally day by day by day, read all these articles to get one extra fact from it, and then try to piece it together. It's not a long episode, but it took me forever to do. And then sometimes I'll have, you know, a long episode that just kind of came together.
Yeah, your research is impeccable. Like, that you ask every single question that as a listener you would have, you've already considered it, and you've gone out of your way to answer those questions.
That's part of why my scripts are like way too long. And sometimes I think, are people even wanting to listen to this anymore? But what it, yeah, that's one of the things that I do is I'll be reading on a case and I'm like, but how did they get to that part? Like, so a lot of times, you know, it's glossed over. It's like, and then they arrested this person. I'm like, well, why? How? What happened in here? Or I'll just be, they'll say something and I just won't have the context for it. So then I have to look it up. And then all those things end up in my scripts. So there's a lot of information in there.
Oh, listening to you is like listening to a friend tell you a story, because it sounds so natural the way you're speaking. And then you're just giving all of the details. So it's sort of like a warmer approach to listening to something that's really dark and could be really upsetting. It's like the way that you present it makes it easier to hear.
Well, that is my goal. One of the things that I have a hard time with some single host podcasts is when it sounds like they're reading. And I have a hard time with audiobooks when it sounds like they're just reading it and it's not really being told to me. And so I always want to make sure that whatever I'm saying, I sound like I'm telling you a story versus like reporting facts off a piece of paper. And so, I mean, it takes some practice to get there. I had a little bit of a head start because I did a lot of public speaking and debate, you know, in school. And I trained as a sign language interpreter, which is a lot of having to speak and sign conversationally, even when what you're doing is someone's literally telling you what to do, but you're supposed to make it seem natural. So I do have practice with it, but it still took a while when I'm doing it for 10,000 words and I'm sitting down for an hour and 15 minutes to do it. I'll find my brain just kind of checking out and I'll be like, okay, wait, I'm reading. I have to go back and re-record that. So it sounds like I'm saying it and telling it, not just reading it.
Yeah, you and Roseanne from California Dreaming do it the very best, because it's just like listening to a friend.
Perfect. That is my goal with the delivery of the podcast.
So what do you do for self-care? Because I know working on true crime, it can be more so for some people than others, but it can be incredibly, it can be taxing, like emotionally, mentally.
So I definitely find that the most important aspect of self-care is very much the hierarchy of needs. You have to make sure your needs are being met. So it doesn't matter if I go get a pedicure on my time off if I didn't get enough sleep for a week. It's not going to matter if I, you know, go do something like really go shopping and buy myself something really nice if like I'm not, you know, my laundry's not done. So a lot of times I find like my self-care is mostly related to making sure I had enough vegetables with lunch. So I've really reined in I've made cooking food a priority in my life. And so I do have a lot of, you know, meat, vegetable kind of recipes that don't take a lot of time, but I remind myself it's better that I spend a half hour doing that and fueling my body properly than pretty much anything else I could do for self-care. I will feel better. And I try to make sure I get enough sleep at night. I started prioritizing my sleep probably 2 years ago, where I said, you know what? I don't care if I didn't finish my work for the day. I don't care if there's a TV show I want to watch. I don't care about anything other than going to sleep. And so I make sure I get enough sleep every night. And then we've talked about exercise before. I really like to exercise. I like doing different things, but I've actually found the one that helps me the best is just long walks. So I walk for 40 to 60 minutes, usually at night I'll start doing it during the day when it gets cold here. But right now it's too hot during the day. So I have to do it like after the sun goes down. And I just go for long walks. And sometimes I'll listen to a podcast and let that clear my head. But sometimes I actually have to just think all my thoughts and get them all out. And so then sometimes I'll just walk around thinking. And so those are, yeah, just making sure my basic needs are met is like radical self-care when you're as busy as I am. It seems a lot just to go to bed on time, but it's so important.
Do you have any pets?
Yeah, I have a dog. I have a miniature schnauzer. His name is Gustavo Avocado because we let children name him. That's what your pets sound like when you let children name them. But yeah, we call him Gus mostly, but he is, we don't know how old he is. He was picked up as a stray. He's blind in one eye. He's got broken teeth. They thought he was about 3 years old, but our vet thinks he's more probably 6 or 7 now. He's got some conditions that don't normally hit younger dogs. So he's a little older than we thought, which was really actually devastating when they told me that. I almost started, I started tearing up in the vet's office because all I could think is, we have less time with him than I thought. Because we're obsessed with him. He's the greatest.
I love the name Gus. Gustavo Avocado. So funny. But yeah. Gus is like the mouse from Cinderella. And then the name
Charlie. Yes.
And the name Charlie is like the dog from All Dogs Go to Heaven. Those are like two of my beloved children's movies.
Yeah. The Gus name comes, I don't know if you've ever watched the TV show Psych.
Oh, I love that show.
Yeah. Yes. My daughter is upset. I mean, I love the show too, but she turns it on when she like falls asleep at night. So he even has a pineapple collar. So he's named from Psych.
That's so cute. Do you find having a pet helps with your stress levels?
No. I mean, I don't because I find like he's one more thing to take care of. So he kind of helps with my stress levels, like the way children help with my stress levels. But, you know, where it's like, they bring work, but they also bring the joy, but it kind of evens out in the end as I'm cleaning up like a mess he made in the house or something.
So when you were like a teenager in your early 20s, what did you envision yourself doing for a career?
Well, I always thought when that I would have like, I had my oldest kid when I was 19. So like being a mom was pretty much like the only thing like I had really like, so, cause I had him young that I've been a parent like pretty much my entire adult life. And so, yeah, I think I really didn't have a lot of vision for things, especially after I had kids and I had him and then 2 years later. So we had our first 4 kids in like 6 years. And so I was 26 when I had my 4th kid. So that was pretty much everything. I did go to school in my early 20s for sign language interpreting, but then my kids ended up homeschooling and it didn't seem like having a career at the same time didn't make sense. And so I ended up, because I thought, well, I'll be ready to work as an interpreter. I'll be a high enough level to do the kind of jobs I want when my kids are in school. And that would be perfect. Once they're in school, I could start, this career. And then it didn't really work out that way. And so I've never worked as a sign language interpreter, even though that's what I went to school for. But I homeschooled my kids and then they went to school and I still had a 2-year-old. And then I later had another one. So the podcasting thing was like a hobby that just sort of turned into a job when people started wanting to put ads on it. Companies were like, you have enough downloads, you get an ad, you know how the process goes. I know a lot of listeners don't understand. And I know a lot of new podcasters don't know. It's a question I get a lot from new podcasters. So how do I get sponsors? And I'm like, wait, you got to take a step back and it takes a minute to get them. But it eventually became like a career. So it just, everything I've done has just kind of accidentally happened and it's worked out. So
I always wondered if like you'd wanted to write a book or something because you're such a good writer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was a kid, I would try to like write books. I'm not a very good creative writer. Like I'm not very good with, I don't have a very vivid imagination. Like I can think up like characters and stuff, but I can't really, they're not very complex and I They don't really do a whole lot. And so I've done some like short story writing, but that's about as most creative writing. So I've definitely found nonfiction writing to be more, you know, where you're, I have all the facts and then I just have to turn them into a story. Like, so all the thinking parts were done for me. There's no imagination needed, but I definitely learned a lot working for Parcast because their scripting style is a lot less. I don't want to say it's not fact-based because obviously it is, but it's, they would rather leave out details and make a scene more, develop a scene more. So they lean a lot more creative in their nonfiction. So I learned a ton about that working for them because I definitely was not there when I started. I mean, I was because they hired me, but I got a lot of notes back in the beginning. Like, this is way too long. that was a common one. They're like, this episode is way too long. Like, half these things we don't need to tell the story. And they very much want to get to the story of it, where I'm like, no, I need every fact in there and I can't leave anything out. So they kind of helped me learn to balance things. And now Crimelines is still very detailed and very long, but there are times where I'm like, this actually isn't relevant. I can leave this out. Just because I found it in an article doesn't mean it needs to be in there.
Yeah, that would be challenging when you're used to putting every single relevant detail and fact in there, because that's what the listeners of your show want.
Yes.
And then you're writing for another show and it's like, you know, hold up. We don't need all this. We just need the bones of the story. And then we want you to flesh it out with kind of more nuance and like details and formulate this story so it reads like a book, I guess.
Yeah, well, and it would be little things like the prosecution would object to something and they would want me to write that the prosecutor stood up and objected. And I'm like, well, I don't know that he stood up. And they're like, well, he probably stood up. I'm like, well, I don't know that he stood up. And it's just like, okay, does that matter? It adds color to the story. It doesn't make the story less true. And so it's very funny because my husband and I went with some friends to the theater recently to watch a production of The Lifespan of a Fact. And the entire play, it's a three character play, and it's a fact checker, an essayist who wrote a very moving piece about a young man who committed suicide, and the editor of the magazine who has to find a common ground between the essayist adding color to the story to make it, and the fact checker being like, no, the bricks aren't red, they're brown. And it's very funny, but then at the end, it's very moving. So after we watched it, we went out across the street for drinks and we're sitting up on the patio. And my friend's like, so how much of that applies to what you do in podcasting? I said, literally all of it. It reminded me so much of writing for Parcast, where you're writing out scenes. You're not writing an article. You're writing an essay. You're writing out scenes and you sometimes add things like the prosecutor standing up, and it doesn't matter. Like, the story is still true, even if that isn't a fact. And it's some people are not for that. Some people hear what I did with Parcast and they're like, that doesn't sound right to me. Other people are like, no, I mean, that's how you tell a story. So everybody comes at it differently. That's why I like writing for myself, because I can do it the way I like to do it.
I prefer your way, but like I think everybody's got their preference. Some people don't necessarily care about the details. They just want a finely crafted story. Mm-hmm. So the prosecutor stood up, he raised his eyebrows, he clasped his hands behind his back. And it's like, well, how do you know that? Did you watch a video of that? That's what I'd be thinking if I heard that.
Right. And that's the thing is, I'm like, I didn't watch the whole trial. I don't know that he did that, but it doesn't change the story and it doesn't impact the victim or the defendant or anything. And it's still, that's part of writing for Parcast I struggled with. But then the episode would come out and I listened and it was so good. Like, I was like, I feel like people are getting the story. They're getting what's important out of the story. Sometimes there's, you know, a lot of times these stories do have a deeper meaning behind them. And you don't have to necessarily always tell people what it is, which is what I do in Crimelines, where I say, this is important because that's what I do on Crime Lines, but that's not how they do it there. And instead you get it from the story, and it's really well done. And I definitely admire people who can do that a lot better than I can, because it took me a very long time to write for Parcast. Like, the amount of time I spent writing the scripts was a lot longer than it is for writing Crime Lines or even Rusty Hinges. And it just took me longer because I'm not very good at that. But the writers they have working there full time are amazing, because they would go over my stuff and send me notes, and they were so good. It was like getting an English class, but I was taking a writing class, but they were paying me to take it. So, I mean, it was a good experience overall.
They must have seen something in your writing, though, that they were like, okay, she's got an incredible potential. That, of course, there's going to be a learning curve. I bet you every single one of those writers that is, you know, that level now that you were like, it's like getting back an English paper, that they went through the exact same growing pains in the beginning. Yeah.
And a lot of the Parcast writers I worked with actually had their degrees in script writing or in creative writing. So they were the creative writers. They weren't necessarily the journalist article writer like I am. So we were coming at it from two different directions, and that probably made for a better script. And I know that I did a good job at Parcast, one, because they kept renewing my contract. And then the other is probably a year or so after I stopped. Yeah, probably about a year after I stopped writing for them, someone from Parcast contacted me kind of like off the record, because he had someone who was working on a podcast and was looking for a writer to be part of the team. And he thought of me. And I was like, well, that's really nice. A year later, you're thinking, oh, wait, I know a good writer, and thought of me. So I'm like, oh, that was really nice. No, I'm not interested, but that was really nice. I'm like, I got my hands full. I can't even keep Crime Lines going all the time.
It would be like going to writer's boot camp or something, right? Because you come from this completely different perspective, and then you're thrown into it. And it's like, now you've got to add this creative flair to it. You're not used to adding and like embellishing and just sort of like putting window dressing, sort of like those details. Like you said, it doesn't take away from the story. It doesn't impact the victim in a negative way, but it might make for a more immersive experience for the listener.
It does. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And it's just not really my strong suit, but I definitely learned a lot. They also, the way Parcast works, and I've actually found most podcasts I write for work the same way, in that they have an overall formula per episode. So if you ever listen to Canadian true crime, almost every episode is going to open with something very scenic. And like very much the landscape, the actual physical landscape of the area. And then the case rolls out largely the way you would have found it in the newspaper. So you're not getting the backstory on the victim until they're already dead, identified, maybe in a re- and then it comes out very naturally. It's a very organic growth of a story. And Crime Lines, I start with the backstory. I say, all right, we're going to start with this is where this person grew up, da da da. It's not very creative, but Crime Lines is a timeline of events, and that's how I structure all of them. Parcast has the same. They're like, this is a two-parter. The first part is this. We end at this point, and then the second part is this. And I'm like, well, sometimes I have more for the first part than the second part. And they're like, this is how we do it. So we got to figure it out. And so it did make me think more about structuring a story and kind of the shape of a story and a balancing a story out for effect. And yeah, I mean, it was like, so it's not just Parcast that has a formula. Most podcasts do. Most of the ones that are scripted that I write for have a preferred like order things happen.
Sort of like with script writing, except for like movies or whatever. There's that. You know, that Joseph Campbell book, The Hero of with a Thousand Faces, I think is the name of it. And a lot of, you know, script writers have read that book because it shows that all these stories throughout mythology, they've got the same sort of, you know, formula that it goes, you know, they present the person and what their normal life is. And then something happens and they step into this other world. They try out this other world. And then, you know, in the final act, they're reconciling their experience in this other world with, you know, their home or whatever. So it's mm-hmm. it's like very formulaic, but as human beings, we like that formula.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Parcast would even have, they would say, okay, well, in Act Two, we need to focus on this. And I'm like, okay, well, because we literally have it spaced out. And it definitely made me think more creatively in a lot of ways, and also more about being very intentional in the story that I'm telling, where I wouldn't leave something out because it doesn't support my story, but still knowing what my story is, I can find where that piece fits. You know, not necessarily, you know, leaving it out. I know a lot of times the whole victim blaming thing comes up, and making sure we are being respectful of the victim while also treating them as a whole person. And if they were doing drugs, they were doing drugs. You know, if they were living a high risk lifestyle, they were living a high risk lifestyle. That's not for me to leave that out because I want to make them seem more of a victim. You know, that's if anything, I need to not do that because I'm trying to break that stigma of being a less than ideal victim.
Oh, and you do a beautiful job of that, where you highlight all of these things about the victim, but that doesn't necessarily mean, because these things are a fact, say they're involved in sex work or mm-hmm. they have an addiction to drugs or alcohol, that doesn't make them any less deserving of justice. So when people omit right. that, it does mm-hmm. a major disservice to other cases right. like that, right? Because it says, oh, there's a shame attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
When you yeah. don't include it, it's like, we feel shameful about these things, so we're not going to include them. So full transparency mm-hmm. like you do is such a refreshing thing.
Yeah, I covered a case recently that was a missing and murdered Indigenous woman case, Brittany Tiger, and her sister said she didn't want the drug angle to necessarily come up because she didn't want people to discount her sister as, you know, oh, well, she used drugs. What do you expect? Where Brittany used drugs, but not everybody who uses drugs is an addict. Just like everybody who drinks isn't an alcoholic. Everybody who has a cigarette every once in a while isn't addicted to smoking. She used drugs occasionally, recreationally, in like a party setting. She wasn't a regular user. And so when her tox screen came out and showed that there was meth in her system, it was like the teeny tiniest amount of meth. Like, I'm like, how did you even find that? I tried to find a study to give an indication of like how much meth that was. And the study I could find, the most reliable study I could find, couldn't even test levels that low. Like, I'm like, how did you even find this meth? So, but she had like teeny tiniest amount of meth, like in her liver. And we know certain organs hold on to toxicology chemicals more. But her sister was worried that once that came out, it's like, oh, well, she probably overdosed or something. And it's like, well, you know, overdosing on meth isn't going to leave that teeny tiny amount. It was probably, who knows when she did that? Like, they can't even tell. And so I definitely want to make sure that I give the full context in cases like that. Or, you know, when I covered a case of a woman who was an alcoholic and largely homeless, and yeah, maybe one of the reasons she didn't survive the attack was because, you know, when you drink a lot, your blood is thinner, and that can contribute. But that doesn't mean that the person who inflicted the injuries didn't kill her, you know? And so all the context needs to be there, all the good and the bad.
Are you familiar with the case of Jessica Easterly?
Mm-mm. No.
Yeah, her sister has been like a really big advocate for Jessica, but she was in a relationship where it looked like there could have been some coercive control, maybe some mm-hmm. domestic violence. There seemed to be some issues there. And Jessica was, I don't know if she was just like habitual user or if she was addicted, but she and her partner did methamphetamine. They were married, actually. They did methamphetamine, and they had a, wasn't like an OnlyFans, but it was something like that. Mm-hmm. And they did porn together. And by the sounds of it, he kind of like pushed her or coerced her into doing this. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much of it was her free will and choice.
Right.
And her body was found, like, she'd gotten into a big fight with her husband, and I think she called her sister or somebody and said, like, I need to get out of here. And later her body is found, like, I think she was basically nude and like with a blanket around her, a close distance to her home. And the way that it was investigated was sort of like, she's like a quote unquote, like throwaway person. You know what I mean?
Right.
The investigators just did not do a thorough investigation and seemed to be like, oh, it's exposure. Oh, it's drugs. It's all of these things. And it's like, you need to dig a little bit deeper. Just because these things were going on in this woman's life does not make her any less deserving of justice and a proper investigation.
Right. Yeah. And the case with the woman who was a chronic alcoholic, her that's a case. She was basically found, her partner said something like, she must have stood up and fallen and bumped her head. And it's like, no, I think she looks like she was beaten. Like, I mean, my personal opinion, reading what I've read of the police reports, I think the police believe it's a homicide. And it's really interesting because what is in those reports and what witnesses said, what the early statements were, and what's been reported in the media, the small amount that has been, are two totally different things. And I even asked her sister, I was like, what happened here? And she goes, I don't know if like whatever press release they gave the media was just like a washed down version and it just got kind of changed. But it was, I mean, what was in the actual statements was a lot more detail. And I think it's interesting because it was her and her partner and her partner's friend staying in this hotel room. And they both of the men put themselves not in the hotel room, but at different times, and they each did different, like their stories don't match at all. Like it's clear they were, one of them was covering for himself and the other was covering for his buddy, but they got it all like mixed up. I don't know. But then the sister had told me they weren't sure where he was, the boyfriend, anymore, because he was never arrested. They weren't sure where he was. And so I did a search on him and found him in jail, and he's in prison in another state. And I was like, here he is. And she's like, I don't know why they couldn't find him. I said, well, the police, they didn't have the time to do that. Like it was not a priority for them. And so they didn't do it, but here he is. And now you know where he is and you know, he's in jail. So yeah, go talk to him. He's right there. He's got nothing else to do. It's really, some of these cases are so frustrating. And this happened in Gallup, New Mexico, which, from what I understand, has a high crime rate. And the police had another murder to investigate, like immediately. You know, it's not like it's this town where they have one murder. It's like, next thing you know, I mean, they barely got statements on this one before they get called to another. I mean, it's hard in those towns.
It's not like Bighorn County where they're not getting that many. And it's like, there's no excuse why you're not investigating this murder or potential murder.
It's like, what were you guys doing? I mean, Bighorn County. Yeah, it's, you know, they have these areas where they get, you know, four suspicious deaths a year and they can spend time on them. But then you have places like Gallup in New Mexico where, I mean, not that every case is a suspicious death, but they have a lot of crime, both property crime and violent crime, and they have to investigate. I have heard from a few people that there is a decent, for the population, there's a shocking amount of gang-related issues in Gallup, where you would think it's not that big of a city, but it has some pretty deep issues.
And I think it's just when investigators are so overrun with cases, they're going to automatically prioritize those that don't seem to have high risk lifestyles, right?
Right.
Because those are the ones that it's like the public can get behind and, you know, politicians can push, and a district attorney can be like, look, I've got justice for so-and-so, where they see them as being more deserving or more meaningful when they do secure a conviction. And like, you see that a lot on, I know you probably know Marissa from The Vanished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like on her show, she'll post reviews sometimes and it makes my blood boil.
Yeah. She gets a ridiculous amount of people who are like, who come out and say, and sometimes she'll get the reviews. Sometimes she'll get them like on her post about the case. People will put that on social media under their actual name where they have to know the family's going to see it. because the family participated in the case. So, of course, they're watching. And it's like, why did you really feel it was necessary to put down that victim for using drugs? And Marissa has a very personal reasons why she wants to make sure these cases get the publicity. She has a family member who has chronic drug issues. It has caused so many issues in her family, but she still looks at it and says, if this family member went missing, I don't want people not to care, because she wasn't clean. She wasn't sober. So it's shocking how like heartless people can be. If you don't want to listen to a case about a drug user, don't listen. Like, you don't have to go tell someone they don't deserve the case to be covered. It's ridiculous.
It's so awful. Like, I remember one she posted recently, and I think it said to reduce it, basically, poor choices, poor outcomes. Seriously, you know that addiction is an incredibly complex thing that usually stems from trauma. Somebody's mm-hmm. trying to escape. And I think that's a rational response to an irrational world. And I don't think that somebody should be vilified for doing that, you know, means by which to escape. And I think it's an incredible struggle for people to get clean, because once mm-hmm. somebody gets clean, they then have to deal with the reasons for which they chose to do drugs or, you know, drink in the first place. And then they've got these compounded issues of traumas that happened while they were using. So right. It's a big hill to climb.
Exactly. And I talked to an addiction specialist years ago who said, I was doing a podcast episode and it was relevant. And I talked to her and she said, we don't have an addiction crisis. We have a trauma crisis and we have a mental health crisis. And I know that I have interviewed people. Debbie Domingo was the daughter of one of the victims of the Golden State Killer. Her mom was murdered by a serial killer alongside her mom's boyfriend, who Debbie was close to and really, really cared for, in her home. And then she was uprooted and moved to her dad's place. She struggled with addiction. She has since gotten clean and she's been sober for a long time. But it's like, are you going to look at her childhood trauma? And when you look at someone's addiction story, you need to look past that and look at their trauma. You need to say, this teenager's mom was brutally murdered. I mean, we know what the Golden State Killer did to his victims. Brutally murdered. The man got away with it until fairly recently. That's a lot for a teenager to handle. And then we look at it in her addiction. We shouldn't look at her as less of a person. And now she's better of a person because she overcame it. Like, she's the same person in all three stages of trauma, addiction, and recovery. She's still the same person. She still has the same value. And giving people different value based on how they deal with trauma that they absolutely didn't ask for is ridiculous. I know Brandy Myers' sister, Kristen. Brandy Myers went missing when she was 13 years old in her neighborhood. She was going door to door doing like a school fundraiser thing, and she disappeared. Brandy asked Kristen to go with her, and Kristen said no. And she even made some kind of snarky little sister comment. She was 10 or 11 at the time. She like didn't even just say no. She's like, I'm not going, you know. And then her sister went missing and got kidnapped. And then her family dealt with it in ways that weren't necessarily the healthiest, seeing as they had a child in the home. But what do you expect of parents who just lost a kid? Like, I mean, you're not always going to be completely present for your children. That's just a fact. So it's like this compounding thing. She fell into addiction. She is now in recovery. And she tells her story to people to be like, whatever you did, I've done worse. And here I am still around. So she tells this great story, but her value as a 10-year-old, as a young mother struggling with addiction, and now as a recovery advocate, her value remained the same throughout that whole thing. But had she gone missing while she was using, someone's going to tell Marissa not to cover her story. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and that
pisses me off.
It's the fact that people want to distance themselves as far away from, you know, any possibility that the same thing could befall them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah, okay, well, this person was doing drugs. I don't do drugs. Therefore, this could never happen to me. So they want to just push it away at arm's length, a safe distance. So them or their children or their friends or loved ones, they could never see it happening. When the reality is it could happen to anybody. It's not just a high risk lifestyle. And those people, just because they're living it, doesn't mean that they asked for that.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that unfortunately those situations can come up that can be contributing factors to people taking advantage and to using that against them. It makes those individuals vulnerable. And it's like you said, it's because of trauma. It's typically mental health issues and trauma. Like, I'm from BC, and in Vancouver, there was a closing of, they had a mental health facility there. And you see this downtown east side where there's a ton of addicts. So you see people that it spilled out onto the downtown east side. So a lot of these people who aren't getting adequate mental health treatment and they're not taking proper medications and they're not very well managed, they're going to seek to balance those brain chemicals or to suppress that trauma in whichever way that they can and that's most readily available. And oftentimes that's street drugs.
Yeah. I just read an ER nurse said what happens when you close the mental hospitals ends up in the ER. And it ends up in the ER for a number of reasons. And, you know, overdoses is absolutely one of them. But when my kids were younger, we did a homeschool field trip. Of all the freaking places, I don't even know why we did this. This actually sounds irresponsible on my part. We went to the county jail. One of the county sheriff's deputies was a homeschool dad. So he's like, well, we could do a tour of the jail. And I was like, well, that would actually be kind of interesting to see. But we did this tour of the jail while people were like in lockup. And they're like, don't go too close to that door. Like, I mean, it was like that. And then we went through the parts where they have to like lock the door behind you and then unlock the next door. This actually, as I'm like reliving this moment, I don't know why I did this. However, on this tour, they mentioned that they've seen a sharp increase in people who are getting arrested since there was a major cutback in on the Kansas side of the Kansas City state line. In Wyandotte County, they had a major defunding of inpatient mental health facilities, and it's extremely difficult to get them. And then they tried to put a Band-Aid with these outpatient services that are stretched to the max, have low compliance rates, because when someone, you know this better than I do, when someone is treating trauma with addiction, they need a long-term plan because they need to detox and get sober first. And then they need to, like, you can't just be like 30 days and you're fine. They are looking at longer term treatment. But when you don't have 90-day inpatient programs and you're doing like, you know, a week inpatient, and then they're supposed to comply with this outpatient intensive treatment, which has low compliance rates. The county lockup was like, we have seen a huge increase in people getting arrested for things like disorderly conduct and just disturbing the peace. And these things that seem so minor, but when someone is having a mental breakdown in public or they're having an anxiety attack and it manifests in them yelling at people walking by them, they end up in jail when they need to be in a hospital.
That's the really sad part, right? Is that these people are out there yelling and screaming. And if they were in a mental health facility, they could be properly medicated and properly managed. If they're qualifying to be in there based on their current mental state, then there's a reason for that. So to put them out onto the street, it doesn't benefit anybody, right? Like to have cutbacks with regards to mental health facilities is never a good thing for any community, any city, on a micro and a macro level.
Right, because there's no alternative. You either get mental health treatment or you don't. We don't have, that is our safety net. Like, the mental health treatment is the safety net to catch people who need help. And if you're not catching them, there's nowhere else for them to go. It's not like they can go to a food bank because they didn't get enough food stamps. There's no Band-Aid for it.
Yeah. And I think that's often why you see people going and trying to kind of fill that gap, because going and getting a prescription from a doctor, going and filling that prescription, somebody who's having a psychotic episode isn't going to be capable of doing that sort of a thing. Like, you're expecting a lot when you're saying an outpatient treatment can solve these problems, when it really just scratches the surface. There's a small percentage of people who it can really and truly help. But these people could just go and get, you know, whatever their drug of choice is off the street. And if that's going to temporarily make them feel better, then that's what they're going to seek out. And I think that's a pretty human reaction.
Yeah, my friend was a nurse practitioner in a free clinic in an impoverished area in the Kansas City metro. I don't want to say too much. I don't want to identify her too much or where she was. But she said she was seeing people for mental health conditions. She's like, I have no business treating these, but they have no other option. She's like, I can't monitor them properly. I'm not a psychiatric nurse. She said, but it's either me or nothing. So they either get their lithium from me and we just do our best, or they are out there untreated, vulnerable, losing jobs because they're struggling so much, not being able to take care of their kids. So she's like, I'm treating bipolar disorder. I'm a general practice nurse practitioner. I should not be treating bipolar disorder. But I mean, her clinic, if I could get them in the door, we've already gone through one of the harder steps. I can't refer them out. The number of mental health professionals who are taking free patients or even Medicaid patients is so small that the wait list is months long. So, I mean, she was treating people because it was either her or nobody.
It's a major problem. Like, in Vancouver, there's a major psychiatric shortage or psychiatrist shortage, where unless you are at the point where you need to be admitted to a facility, you can't get in to get a psychiatrist to prescribe you medications. So what you're left to do is what I personally done in the past, you know, when I needed antidepressants or needed any other kind of medication, is had to go to my general practitioner and been like, this is what I want. I've done the research. Here it is. And these are the doses that I think will work. And luckily, I've had doctors that have trusted me and that have trusted my research and have been like, okay, that looks like it checks out. But other people don't necessarily know how to do the research, nor do they have a doctor who will listen to them. Right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's really difficult here in Kansas City. One of our biggest shortages is in pediatric, psychiatric, and behavioral help. And so childhood is that point of intervention where so much can change. Especially when you have a family who wants nothing more than to help their kid and they're willing to drive anywhere you need them to, they will wait 3 months for a basic evaluation. They'll wait 3 months for the intake to get the evaluation in 9 months. But then when we can't provide services, then to children who have behavioral issues, what is happening when they're 14, 15, 16? We are like causing the problems that we're not equipped to solve later. I mean, we have just such a huge shortage of pediatric psychiatric help at all in this area.
It's so unfortunate because a lot of these interventions, if done in childhood, can completely change the trajectory of the lives of not only the individuals who are affected, but every single person in that family who is impacted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a lot of friends who've had various levels. I mean, I know when my son was going through a lot of developmental evaluations, I had one place that would do like the comprehensive evaluation on him. I had to call, and a nurse called me to approve me to make an appointment. And when they decided that, yes, he could make an appointment, he qualified to make an appointment, they said, we will call you when we have appointments opening up. And that call was going to be in like 6 to 12 weeks. And that call would let me make an appointment that was for several weeks or months out. They're like, well, we're already booked up for the 6 months we book. So when we open up more appointments, we'll let you know. And it was like, how do you get a kid help? Especially if they're already in school, they're not doing well, they're struggling, which a lot of times behavioral issues are springing out of learning disabilities that aren't being treated. It's like, how do you manage all of that? And if you don't have a parent who's willing to manage all of that, or doesn't have the time, or there's a language barrier, a lot of kids are getting left behind.
Yeah, it's really sad because societally, like, what does that say? That, mm-hmm. you know, we don't value the mental health of our children, which then is yeah. going to change the way that society is structured when those children grow up and their needs yes. haven't been addressed. Mm-hmm. And we see military budgets that are bloated and yes. so big. And then we see certain things that should be seen as basic mm-hmm. needs and rights of taxpaying citizens. And right. they fall by the wayside.
It's ignored. And it benefits all of society for people to have access to mental health. It doesn't just benefit the individual. And it benefits from any way you, if you want to look at it from the capitalist workforce angle, having fewer people homeless and more people working and being able to maintain a job because they're mentally healthy is better for everybody than what we have right now. And if you look at it from a more empathetic human level, it's better for them and their families, and they contribute better to just the welfare of others. And there's really no angle at which you can look at mental health treatment and say, yeah, we should cut it because that's better for us. It's not better for anyone. And it's just, it's one of the many things I don't understand. I think one of the main reasons it gets cut is because there are not enough people advocating for it not to get cut. I think there are just not enough people there are so many battles to fight in this world that we tend to fight the ones that affect us the most. And for most of us, severe mental illness is not affecting us. And if it is, we're not in a position to advocate. And I think that's why mental health programs get cut so easily.
It's so unfortunate because if you've been touched by, you know, a family member or somebody you're mm-hmm. friends with who's really gone through it. My mom has bipolar 1 and she mm-hmm. eventually went on disability in her 40s. And this was, oh gosh, like, I don't know, in the 2000s at some point. She dealt with a lot of blowback from the people she worked with because it's invisible, right?
Yeah.
And there's like mm-hmm. a stigma attached, like, oh, she seems fine. Like, she's just faking it. When in reality, yeah. it's like this person's like on the edge of a cliff struggling mm-hmm. like to get by day by day. And all yeah. of these people and their attitudes towards it are basically, it's not because they're cruel. It's just because they're uneducated on it and they're not mm-hmm. personally touched by somebody right. who's experienced mental illness. And I think we've come a long way in the last 10 years, but we still have a long way to go.
Yeah, we definitely do. Because I mean, there are times where someone will say they're really struggling and I'll be like, what are you struggling over? Like, you know, and then I was like, wait, no, because a lot of times what we're struggling with may not be an external factor, but it's internal brain chemicals and the way things are balanced. And for me or anyone else to be like, your life's pretty good. What are you depressed over? That's ridiculous, because depression doesn't actually need to have a reason. It can, you know, I have a cyclical depression issue, and it is 100% a chemical. Like, there's nothing, and I never know when it's going to hit. It's not triggered by anything. It's not triggered by the sun going down. It's not triggered by winter. It's not triggered necessarily by trauma, but usually when it hits, past trauma is what I tend to like think about because it kind of fuels itself. But it's a serotonin issue. And if I take an SSRI through it, it works. And so I know that it is a chemical cyclical balance thing that nobody knows why it happens. So I can look at my own life and be like, and trust me, when I'm depressed, I do that. I'm like, why am I depressed? I have nothing to be depressed about, which only like makes me feel worse for myself, where I'm like, oh, now I can't, I'm not even grateful. I'm such a terrible person. So, you know, kind of feeds itself.
Yeah, it becomes like this cyclical rumination where you're like ruminating yeah. about your depression, but also about things from the past and then potential yeah. future things. And then it's like, why do I feel the way that I feel? I should be so grateful. There's people mm-hmm. in the world that don't have, you know, food and clothing, and I have yeah. all of this, but yet I feel this way. And you're absolutely right. It's I have bipolar too. So I have sort of mm-hmm. the same experience where when the highs aren't like when my mom has them, when it's extreme and she needs to be hospitalized, it's right. just like, I don't need as much sleep and I'm more mm-hmm. creative. But then the lows are more frequent and it's like trying to pull yourself out of bed some days.
Yeah.
It's difficult and your energy feels low. And you're like, why do I feel this way? I have so much to be grateful for. And mm-hmm. then you start hating yourself for it. So I think it's just
yeah.
coming to that place where it's like, okay, I'm not my thoughts and I might mm-hmm. be experiencing this, but it doesn't need to define me and it will pass.
Right. Yeah, I think when you go through enough cycles of it, when you are in a situation where it's not the extreme manic and depressive episodes, but they're, I mean, not saying they're functional or they're fun, but they're at least in the realm of that, you can tell yourself, you're still in the mind where you can say, this is the cycle, it will pass. And so I just, you know, I definitely try, sometimes I commit myself to things while I'm in the high that I don't want to, like, I might, it's like I started my YouTube channel at a high where I'm like, I'm going to put out tons of content and I have all this time and da, da, da. And then I get to a low and I'm like, oh, manic Charlie commits depressed Charlie to way too many things. And I just, you know, sometimes that extra energy is great. And I get tons of podcast scripts done and I get everything done and everything's great. And, I'm doing live streams all the time. And then there are times where like where I am right now, where I had to take a week off because I just couldn't get everything done. And there were a lot of reasons I was going out of town and there were a ton of things, but I just could not get it done. And now I'm like, okay, well, I'm back and I took a week off. So now I should be ahead, but I'm not. Like I can't do that. And I'm like, I need just like, if I could just get like a good month of some manic energy to get some shit done, but it's not working out right now.
It's hard though, because I get the same way. Like I will get so much done and I will overcommit myself to mm-hmm. so many different things and I'll want to do everything. And then yeah. all of a sudden I hit a wall. Like I cannot
mm-hmm. yes.
look at editing. I cannot look at scripts. I do not want to read anything related to it. I don't want to listen to true crime. And yeah. I just retreat inside myself and I'm like, I need a week or I need some time. And mm-hmm. when I take it, I feel like I should automatically be refreshed, but it doesn't always yeah. work like that. It's not linear.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, so some of my self-care in those times is to just be like, this is where I am, because I only feel worse if I try to push myself and I'm not productive. Then I start getting the, why am I so lazy? Why can't I focus? Why can't I do this? Why can't I do that? So sometimes like, I'm like, you know what, if I'm going to spend a day and I'm just going to watch stupid YouTube videos, that's just what I'm going to do. And it doesn't make me better the next day. Like you said, I don't necessarily feel refreshed, but at least I don't feel any worse. Whereas if I pushed myself through and like made mistakes and couldn't focus and all that, then I start feeling like if I sit down to work and I don't get anything done, I feel worse than if I just took the day off. I just really do. So sometimes I just need to take the day off.
Yeah, I think what you deserve to take the day off, because when you're doing so many different things, I totally relate though. My experience is probably very similar, though we've got different life circumstances.
Yeah.
It's the same. Like when I feel like that, yesterday I couldn't look at anything. And so I was mm-hmm. like, okay, I just ordered this book, this Neil Gaiman book, The Ocean at the End mm-hmm. of the Lane. And so I'm like, I'm going to read this whole book today. And I did. And yeah. I'm like, at least I feel accomplished. I didn't do anything I needed to, but right. I read the book and I feel like that fed my soul in a way.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you just need to do what you can do and not necessarily what you need to do. And I think when people talk about, oh, productivity culture and busy culture and hustle culture is bad for us, I think it's like extra bad for when you're at a low point. And I think very few people have completely even moods. And I think a lot of times they don't recognize the ups and downs. And so they feel either good about themselves or bad about themselves based on these ups and downs, when it's really mostly just your brain chemistry.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's probably lots of people who are listening that have experienced maybe a lesser version of it, but mm-hmm. where they're like, hey, all week I felt motivated. And after the weekend, I thought, hey, I'm going to be refreshed, ready for Monday, but I could barely get out of bed.
Yeah.
And maybe it's, and you start looking for excuses, right? Like maybe it's the weather. Maybe it's because mm-hmm. it's wintertime. Maybe I've got seasonal affective disorder. And
right.
I think that a lot of people have undiagnosed mental health conditions where mm-hmm. they're either afraid to talk to a doctor about that, or doctors could be dismissive sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had doctors be dismissive of some really pretty serious things. And so I have what's considered a mild form of rheumatoid arthritis, and I've had it for a long time since I was in my 20s. And so my rheumatologist said, I want to send you for a second opinion before we move forward. So he's like, find another rheumatologist in the area on your insurance and just go and see what they say. And I went to her and she told me the problem is I don't sleep enough and I have too many children. And that she was sure that once I stopped having kids and got a good night's sleep, I would feel better.
Oh, wow.
And she didn't say like anything about like doing a sleep study. Like she didn't have a reason that I wasn't getting enough sleep, just I had kids, so I must not be getting enough sleep. And I'm like, my joints really hurt. And so I went back to my rheumatologist and I said, that was an awful experience. And so he was like, well, let's go ahead and start treating what I think you have, even if I don't have the blood tests to support it, which is why mine is mild. And so it doesn't show up on the blood test. And so he gave me an immunosuppressant. And he's like, if it's autoimmune, this will fix it. He's like, you'll feel better. And so I started doing these injections that were awful. But I like immediately, within like 2 weeks, I was like, I felt so much better. And I was like, I need to write her a letter and tell her, you know, you dismissed me having a pretty significant thing that could impact my future joint mobility because you thought I didn't get enough sleep. Like it was, she took a call from her husband in the middle of the appointment. The whole thing was a mess, but
putting the blame on you.
That's like literally like I had a physical issue that was documented and different symptoms were documented. And she still was like, you should sleep more.
It's like putting all the onus on you and all the responsibility on you. It would be like an oncologist saying like, oh, you got cancer because you did this. This is your fault.
Right? Exactly.
It's like, not the right approach at all.
It was not a great approach. And so I was not very happy. But, you know, so doctors will dismiss you. And when it's a mental health condition and it's all self-report, like I don't have a blood test for you. I don't have a brain scan to prove my serotonin levels dropped. But you just have to believe me. And it's sometimes that doesn't work.
So mm-hmm. it's like when these people, the doctor must know, like they know best, but they don't always know best. And you know your own experience.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So thank you for tuning in to these special episodes with Charlie from Crime Lines. Thank you, Charlie, for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was nice to get to chat with you face to face on Zoom, but still face to face.
Still face to face. So where can the listeners find you on social media and all that good stuff and your YouTube channel?
Yeah. I mean, if you search for Crime Lines, one word, or Crime Lines True Crime, pretty much anywhere, that's where you'll find me.
I want to thank you all for listening. I would love to hear from you all. If any of you have anything to say, you can reach out to me at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com, or I'm really, really active on Twitter. So please follow me. I'll follow you back at Podcast Riddle. And I just wanted to let you all know, if you're unaware, I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but I have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman. So at the $3 level, you get early access, ad-free episodes. At the $5 level, there's a Jules and Ashley, where either Ashley will tell me a story or I'll tell Ashley a story. And it will be conspiracy theories solved, unsolved, kind of a little bit of everything. At the $10 level, there's a Path Went Chilly mini. So we'll have Robin joining us for that. So we're really, really excited. I will link that in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything. Music by Jobbers.